on this edition of Celebrating Science, David C. Lindberg on Galileo, the Church, and the Cosmos. Brought to you by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics, an independent, nonprofit scientific research and education outreach organization, home to a growing cluster of international scientists who contemplate and calculate new ideas about the very essence of space, time, matter, and information. Perimeter Institute also offers a wide array of educational outreach activities for students, teachers, and members of the general public in order to share the joys of scientific research, discovery, and innovation. In this presentation, The Florentine Heretic, Galileo, the Church, and the Cosmos, David C. Lindberg explores the historical ties between Christianity and science and how Galileo's revolutionary ideas about the cosmos challenged not only the Church's teachings, but also its authority. Professor Lindberg is Professor Emeritus in the History of Science at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. He is currently co-editing the 8-volume Cambridge History of Science with Ronald Numbers.
I'm here to tell you a story. A story that relates closely to the historical relations between science and religion, which is one of my several specialties. I've chosen to tell you the story of Galileo's struggle with the Inquisition of the Catholic Church, one of the most notorious episodes in the long history of the relationship between science and Christianity, often told and almost always misunderstood. It has been used to illustrate and reinforce the dominant interpretation of the relationship between science and Christianity, namely that Christianity and science have engaged in continuous warfare, Christian religion repeatedly erecting obstacles against scientific progress and free scientific inquiry. I will argue that, properly understood, the Galileo story teaches a far more complicated and a far more interesting lesson. Now, in the story that I'm going to tell you, I will be neither attacking nor defending the Catholic Church. My failure to attack it has sometimes opened me to the accusation of setting out to defend my mother church. To make certain that there are no misunderstandings today, let me point out that I was raised in the bosom of American Protestant fundamentalism. In my childhood home, Catholics had about the same approval rating as Democrats and Communists. since we've gotten into my personal biography now, I should perhaps add that I am now a Democrat, but neither a Catholic nor a Communist. but I have many of my very best friends are Catholics. Not too many of them are Communists, but you know. I need to begin with a few words about ancient and medieval cosmology, just to set the scientific context. Ancient cosmologies, almost without exception, were geocentric. That is, they were built on the assumption that the Earth is a spherical body, fixed, motionless, in the center of the universe. The Earth's in the center, everything else goes around it in circles. That was the view of Aristotle, the view of the ancient astronomer Ptolemy, and of every medieval scholar who addressed the question. Now, you may have noticed that I slipped a claim into the sentence before last about the sphericity of the Earth, claiming that all medieval people believed the Earth was spherical. That may come as a surprise to you, but the fact is that we do not know of a single person in medieval Latin Europe who did not, I mean, educated person who did not believe that the Earth was spherical. But that's not our subject. That's tonight. That's something else. Our subject is geocentrism versus heliocentrism. In 1543, a church administrator named Nicholas Copernicus from northern Poland published a book in which he defended the heliocentric alternative, That is, sun in the center, planets in orbit around that sun. In his book, he worked out detailed mathematical models that enabled him to predict planetary positions to a very high degree of accuracy. And if that's true, and I assure you that it is, why did Copernicus's contemporaries and immediate successors, including astronomers who thoroughly understood his system, who had mastered his book, why did they not accept the heliocentric model on which it was based? And the answer really is quite simple, because the evidence in favor of heliocentrism at that time was weak. We're not interested in the evidence available, I'm not interested tonight in the evidence now available, but what was available in 1543 when Copernicus published that book. There was no observation taken by itself capable of proving that the Earth was a planet moving through space. In fact, observation confirmed just the opposite. I mean, if you want to look at the Earth, go out and look at it, and it'll be very, very stationary. Predictions using the new system, Copernicus's predictions were no more accurate than were the predictions of the old geocentric Ptolemaic model. Identical. Both of them were using basically the same observations and the same mathematical techniques in their models. The advantages of heliocentrism, such as they were, fell into the elusive realm of what a physicist might today call theoretical elegance. That is, the heliocentric model was geometrically prettier, more uniform. That is, the models of one planet was more like the model of the other planets than in the Ptolemaic system. And it contained fewer ad hoc features. Let me give just one example. There are several others, but I have time for just the one. There's this interesting phenomenon. If you observe the stars and the planets against the background of the stars, observe a given planet between one night and the next, just keep on going, you'll find that that planet crawls slowly in a west to east direction against the background of the stars. But time comes when they slow down, all of them do, they slow down, reverse themselves briefly, slow down again, and then resume their west to east course. So they make a little loop. This was known to astronomers all the way back to Babylonian times. The question is, why should the universe be that kind of thing? I mean, why would a creator God who is omnipotent and who is perhaps a geometer to boot have this strange phenomenon, the planets moving as they move against the background of the stars make a loop? Copernicus can answer the question. And here, what we have here is, this is the Earth, the inside planet. We're going to be observing the planet Mars from various positions of the Earth. When the Earth is in position one, Mars in position one, there's the stellar sphere out there, and you can plot the line of sight out against the fixed stars. And notice with the line of sight, what happens? We're moving progressively in this direction, one, two, three, but then we go back, four, five, and then we resume this direction again. It's simply an optical illusion, owing to the fact that the Earth is moving on an inside orbit and it's moving faster than Mars is on this orbit just outside it. So Copernicus can explain retrograde motion. It makes sense now. You understand it. You say, aha, that's why we have retrograde motion. That's the kind of advantages the Copernican model had over the geocentric model. And that's the only kind of advantage, it seems to me, that it had. And there are several others that I can't go into. It explained why in Ptolemy's models there is a curious annual element to the individual model for each of the planets that Ptolemy couldn't explain, just simply said that's what the model requires in order to make accurate predictions. Copernicus can explain why that is the case. He adds intelligibility, brings intelligibility to the heliocentric model. Now, against these advantages, there were some pretty solid disadvantages. First of all, heliocentrism represented a massive violation of common sense. And common sense is not to be underestimated. I mean, even scientists have common sense, and it plays a role in the decisions they make. Heliocentrism violated the only coherent system of physics then available, Aristotle's physics. And it does not help to argue that Aristotle's physics was wrong. I mean, if we're going to understand what's going on, we have to contextualize. We have to look at the evidence available to the historical actors we're talking about. And the only physics they had, and it made a whole lot of sense in so many ways, comprehensive, the heliocentric model was simply inconsistent with it, and therefore represented a massive violation of scientific common sense. Hurling the Earth into the heavens totally destroyed the dichotomy between heavens and Earth, which had been central to European people's view of the world for at least 2,000 years. I mean, there's Earth down here and there are heavens up there, right? I mean, the celestial, terrestrial region. Earth and what's above the Earth. But if the Earth is hurled into the heavens, that conception is destroyed and creates kind of a domino effect of other conceptions that one has to modify. Finally, if you really, you know, want an empirical test, I mean, if you want some observation that will settle the matter, we really have one, or it seems to me we come pretty close to having one. There's a small matter of stellar parallax. This is not the way a modern astronomer would think of parallax, but this is the way they talked about parallax. Here we have the Copernican model, heliocentric, sun in the center. Take the Earth in two positions. Here it is, one position, observing the angle between the lines of sight to two stars, star one and star two. Wait 6 months. The Earth is now back here, 10 million miles farther away. That's Copernicus's figure. It's about 1/20th of our value. But this distance, it's 10 million miles. Measure the angle between the lines of sight to those same two stars. It's got to be smaller. It's got to be smaller, but it isn't. No parallax is observed. No difference in the angle between those lines of sight. Now, the only way a heliocentrist can deal with that is to argue that those stars are so far away in that direction that 10 million miles is an infinitesimal by comparison. And it's absurd to talk, it certainly was absurd in the 16th century to argue that 10 million miles was infinitesimal. I mean, that's a hell of a lot of distance. And so it seems to me that the intellectual work you have to do if you're going to save the heliocentric model against this observation is so serious as really not to be a serious option at the time in the 16th century. So the disadvantages were powerful in my view. The advantages were not decisive. They were powerful if they had their own power, but they were not decisive. And before the end of the century, there were respectable alternatives to which one might be rationally committed. There's this astronomer Tycho Brahe who presented a view that was had the Earth in the center, but everything else was heliocentric. I don't want to go into it. There's just not time. Talk to me or ask questions afterwards about that. As a result, hardly anybody took the system seriously as a description of physical reality for half a century. The system, the heliocentric model, was not rejected because of closed-mindedness or blind conservatism, but on the basis of deeply and knowledgeably held scientific principle. The arguments against it were too powerful. The first serious critics perceived the theoretical elegance of the heliocentric theory. They used it for calculations, because it was a bit easier to calculate with, but they knew that it could not represent physical reality. Theoretical elegance isn't enough. A theory can be theoretically elegant and also false. As for the Catholic Church, a key player in our story, there was hardly a stir. Copernicus had been talked into publishing his book by various friends, including ecclesiastical officials. He dedicated it to the Pope, something you did not do without the Pope's permission. And except for one or two people, nobody judged his ideas dangerous. Foolish, perhaps, but no threat. Now, Galileo, here's the old geezer himself. Galileo became involved in heliocentrism 65 years later. The year was 1609. The telescope had been invented the previous summer by a Dutchman. It circulated as a toy. You could spy on your neighbors. Galileo learned of it from a friend, quickly produced one for himself, increased its magnification all the way up to 20 power. That's the most powerful telescope he ever had. And he turned it to the heavens. It was Galileo who converted the toy into a scientific instrument. He made some startling discoveries with his telescope. New stars, previously unseen. Mountains, valleys, and craters on the moon became clearly visible. Venus had phases. Jupiter had satellites. Saturn had a ring, and the sun had spots. In 1610, the year after he learned of the telescope, Galileo published a book entitled The Starry Messenger, in which he described his telescopic observations and used them as arguments in favor of heliocentrism. Which raises the question, how do these arguments prove the truth of heliocentrism? Well, they don't. They lend a certain amount of additional plausibility to the heliocentric system, but they certainly don't prove it to be true. Let me supply a single example. One of the major objections, I think the major objection, certainly with the most emotional content anyway, objection to the heliocentric model was its claim that a great heavy sphere like the Earth is sailing through space at some incredible rate of speed. I mean, that's just not going to fly. I guess that's not really a good not a good metaphor here. The Earth, after all, was regarded as the most stable thing there is. The one thing you can count on is that the Earth is there, rock solid, a stable element in the universe. But Galileo's lunar observations made it possible to argue that the Moon and Earth are topographically similar. They both have mountains and craters and valleys, and therefore must be made of the same stuff. And the moon is sailing through the heavens on everybody's cosmology. I mean, every cosmological system has the moon up in the heavens. And so Galileo is able to argue, well, if the moon can do it and the Earth is similar to the moon, then why not the Earth? Certainly doesn't prove that the Earth is out there in space, but it undercuts, to some extent, one of the objections to the heliocentric model. So the point is that Galileo had arguments rather than proof. And in marshaling these arguments, he deployed his remarkable rhetorical gifts, which is to say that his arguments were as notable for their emotional power as for their logical power. Galileo's aim was not merely to produce carefully reasoned scholarly papers of the sort that physicists at the Perimeter Institute write. His goal was to win the debate in the public arena, rather like modern legal system, the American legal system at least, where the goal of the defense attorney is not to bring out the truth, but to win. I mean, to win the argument, whatever it takes. This is what the rhetorical tradition in Galileo's day taught one to do, and this is what Galileo was trying to do. He can to win the argument by whatever means are available to him. So this was part scholarly argument, part propaganda campaign, and to be truthful about it, part quest for patronage. I'm not going to talk about patronage any further, but this did win the patronage battle for Galileo. The question, the more important question, is why did this get Galileo into trouble, whereas 65 years earlier, heliocentrism had caused no stir? And the answer is that in that 65 years, the climate of opinion within the Catholic Church had changed. And why had the climate of opinion within the Church changed? Primarily because of the Protestant Reformation. Symbolic date, 1517, when Martin Luther nailed the 95 Theses to the Wittenberg church door. This Protestant Reformation split Europe roughly into Protestant and Catholic halves. And naturally, the Catholic Church reacted to this, having just lost half of Europe as a result of what could easily be construed as relaxed or liberal policies. The Church turned conservative and traditional. It became a great deal more worried about controversy and dissent, and it took a much stricter view of biblical interpretation, re-emphasizing the importance of the literal sense, which was not of nearly such great importance during the Middle Ages, re-emphasizing the importance of the literal sense and refusing to embrace any interpretation not sanctioned by church tradition or the church fathers. And in particular, the leading theologians affirmed emphatically that they would be the interpreters of the Bible. They needed no help from laymen. So it was in this new authoritarian climate that Galileo published this little book, The Starry Messenger, in 1610. The next year, 1611, he made a triumphant visit to Rome, where he displayed his telescope and his telescopic observations. He was treated as a celebrity, acclaimed by various dignitaries, including the Jesuits. By this time, the Jesuits were the educators of Catholic Europe, with a string of Jesuit universities across the European landscape. Galileo went to the Collegio Romano, the flagship university of that system. Professor of astronomy confirmed his telescopic observations. The myth you probably have all heard about leaders of the church refusing even to look through the telescope is pure mythology. Galileo's workshop could not turn out telescopes fast enough to satisfy the demand emanating from the College of Cardinals. Every one of those people wanted one for themselves. And in this 1611 visit to Rome, Galileo was really treated as a celebrity and his observations confirmed, but not his interpretation of them. That was quite a different matter. Back home, a bit of local opposition was beginning to surface. It came to be seen, especially by a group of quite conservative Dominicans, that that heliocentrism posed a threat to the literal sense of Scripture and became a concern around which opposition to Galileo among conservative Florentine Dominicans could coalesce. So there's a bit of trouble. It's local, and Galileo sort of becomes gradually aware of it, and it's not comfortable. 3 years later, Galileo published another work in which he entitled Letters on Sunspots, which dealt more with the telescopic observations and their relationship to heliocentrism. Galileo, that led to even additional attacks. There's more worry about among conservatives in Florence about this Galileo character. Galileo, who was always cocky, thought he was God's gift to the universe, defended himself in an open letter to his friend Benedetto Castelli, which was soon circulating in multiple copies. An open letter was handwritten, meant to be copied by hand and circulate among the intelligentsia of Florence. In that letter, he pointed out that nature and the Bible are complementary parts of God's revelation and therefore cannot conflict. He argued that the Bible is not written in scientific language and is not to be interpreted literally when it deals with what appear to be scientific matters. Indeed, he went on to argue that the scientist can teach the theologian how to interpret the Bible where it touches on scientific matters. And here, Galileo is beginning to walk on dangerous turf, because out of the Council of Trent came the notion that the theologians don't need any help from laymen like Galileo. Well, instead of quieting the controversy, Galileo's letter stirred it up. The bishop of Fiesole, which is a little hill town just outside Florence, the bishop of Fiesole called for a sermon in which he called for the jailing of Copernicus. I remind you that Copernicus had been dead for 70 years, but this bishop didn't know that. He only knew that this Copernicus was a menace and should be kept off the streets. About the same time, a Dominican named Niccolo Lorini secured a copy of this open letter that had been circulating and sent it to a friend of his in Rome who was a member of the Inquisition, sent it with a cover letter in which he suggested that this Galileo was a troublemaker and that that he deserved some watching. Well, Galileo didn't know about that yet. He'd find out soon enough. But he does foresee trouble and decides that he must go to Rome once again to make his case in person. Galileo is convinced that he has good arguments, and he is politically naive enough to believe that arguments were what this contest was about. Galileo was politically naive on several very unfortunate occasions. Galileo had fond memories of that 1611 visit to Rome when he was treated as a celebrity, so he's not at all hesitant to go again. He likes some more of that. In Rome, he cut quite a figure. He did the cocktail party circuit. He argued his case with passion wherever opportunity presented itself. He was clever. He was arrogant. He was impetuous. And he seems, on balance, to have been more effective in stirring up trouble and making enemies than, as he had hoped, laying the matter to rest. One of his favorite techniques, and we do have eyewitness testimony on this from the Florentine ambassador. Florence and the Vatican States were separate countries, and so Florence had an ambassador in Rome who was given the job of tailing Galileo and keeping watch over him, and he's scared to death about what's happening. Points out that one of Galileo's favorite techniques is to engage, at one of these soirees, to engage some powerful figure, maybe a powerful member of the College of Cardinals, in a debate, lead him on, and then spring a trap and make him look like a fool in front of his friends. The friends loved it, of course, but the cardinal, the person whose opinion mattered, had become an enemy. So Galileo got lots of attention, and he certainly did have his friends and supporters, not a huge band of them, but there are quite a few. But he did not convince the people who counted. Indeed, it was during this visit to Rome by Galileo, the year is now 1616, he was there for several months, the Inquisition finally acting on that letter that Lorini had sent, the open letter by Galileo, the cover letter by Lorini. The Inquisition finally acted on those charges, censuring two propositions that embodied the essentials of the heliocentric system. And this really is the crucial moment in the story. The Inquisition is concerned about two propositions, that the sun is at rest and that the earth is in orbit around it. Those are heliocentric propositions. Those were declared foolish, absurd, and heretical. And Copernicus's book was put on the index of prohibited books until corrected. Now, this was the critical turning point in Galileo's heliocentric campaign, and we must pause and consider what lay behind this declaration. I mean, why did the Inquisition decide as it did? And if we're going to understand that, we need to stand in the shoes of those who formulated the decision, insofar as we can. The issue was who gets to decide claims to cosmological truth. Were cosmological truth claims dependent on the human capacities of reason and sense experience, or on biblical revelation, on science or on theology? Reason, so Galileo claimed, taught the mobility of the earth. But revelation, so said the leading theologians of the church, clearly taught its fixity. And let me give you three of the passages. There are about half a dozen that entered in. Joshua 10, verses 12 and 13. Then spoke Joshua to the Lord in the day when the Lord gave the Amorites over to the men of Israel. And he said in the sight of Israel, Sun, stand thou still at Gibeon, and thou moon in the valley of Ajalon. And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed until the nation took vengeance on their enemies. The Israelites need to finish off the Amorites. They need more time. And so what does Joshua command? He does not command the earth to stop rotating on its axis or stop revolving about the sun. He demands the sun to stand still. It's apparent that the sun is otherwise the thing that is moving. This is clearly a geocentric passage. Ecclesiastes 1:5, the sun rises and sets and hastens to the place of its rising. What could be more heliocentric than that? It's the sun that does the moving. And Psalm 104:5, thou didst set the earth on its foundations so that it should never be shaken. And that word shaken was, the significance of was inflated quite a bit, I think, by various people. And it was part of the argument as well. Add to these passages a further philosophical consideration. And this is important. So if you're just thinking this would be a good time to nod off, it wouldn't. Stay awake here. Many astronomers, probably the majority at the time, maintained that astronomical models were designed merely to predict planetary observations with no pretense of describing physical reality. That's the dominant view. It's just these are mathematical models that make accurate predictions, so we'll use them. But we know the universe is not, it does not represent the structure of the universe. We can't get up into that. The argument is that God could have in many different ways produced these observations. There'd be many different mechanisms, and we don't know which mechanism God chose. We can't get up there to see and find out what he used, and therefore, it just does not deal with physical reality. So put yourself in the epistemological shoes of the leading theologians. On the one hand, we have what seems to be clear political, biblical statements to the effect that the sun moves while the earth is fixed. Against it, what do we have? Scientific proof? No. Scientific opinions and arguments asserted within a climate that cast doubt on the ability of the human intellect ever to discover the true cosmological system. So it was not as the church leadership saw it, and it's their view we're trying to understand here. It's their decision, the Inquisition that we're trying to understand. As they saw it, it was not biblical certainties against scientific certainties, but biblical certainties against improbable scientific conjectures. From the church's perspective, no choice could have been easier. Now, the church has been often vilified for not modifying its interpretation of these passages in order to get into step with the latest scientific opinion. Let me make clear, therefore, that the church was in step with the latest scientific opinion. The overwhelming scientific majority was still geocentric. If the Pope, in a fit of democratic fervor, had decided to have a secret ballot among all European astronomers about, between heliocentrism and geocentrism, heliocentrism would have lost by a landslide. How inconceivable that the Catholic Church would violate its own or would overthrow its own traditional principles of biblical interpretation and majority scientific opinion, overwhelming majority scientific opinion, in order to jump on the bandwagon of this arrogant Florentine nut. Seems to me that if you and I had been there, we would have voted the same way. I mean, do you want to go with the scientific majority or not? Copernicanism was censured then in 1616. It was declared heresy. And this is the crucial moment, 1616, declared false and heretical. Galileo was in no danger. He was not declared a heretic. He was simply called in by the papal chief of staff and informed that heliocentrism had been declared false and heretical and was not to be held or defended. And Galileo said, okay, he acquiesced. I mean, you know, he realized he had no choice, and it was a formality, and so that was the end of it as far as he was concerned. What was important is that his heliocentric campaign has been derailed, but his personal safety was not at issue. 3 years later, I mean, Galileo goes back to Florence, and he's got other irons in the fire, and he's doing lots of other things. 3 years later, Europe was visited by a series of highly visible comets, one after another, three in a row. I don't know at what intervals, but pretty close. Everybody was aware of them. Galileo became involved in a bitter controversy with a leading Jesuit scientist regarding the nature of comets. What are comets? That controversy culminated in a vicious attack by Galileo on this Jesuit astronomer, what one historian has called the most vicious attack in the entire history of science. He accused this Jesuit astronomer of rude behavior, fraud, intellectual theft, questioned not only his intelligence but also his ancestry. And the critical point here is that Galileo had had friendly relations with the Jesuits ever since 1611. Remember, he went down to the Collegio Romano in Rome, and he was acclaimed by the Jesuits, and they had been on his side. I mean, the fact that the Dominicans in Florence were against him made it clear to the Jesuits that Galileo was okay. I mean, they were not going to be on the same side of the fence as the Dominicans. And so here are crucial allies that Galileo alienates. They were powerful allies, or would have been powerful allies. He poisoned the waters. Well, Pope Paul V died in 1621. He'd been the pope throughout the story I've been telling you. In 1623, there was an interim pope, but then in 1623, a new pope, Maffeo Barberini, was elected, as took the papal name Urban VIII, and I'll refer to him as Urban. And this is an incredible stroke of luck, because Urban is one of Galileo's admirers and friends. I think it's not too much to say friend. At one point when Galileo was ill, he's getting old now and was ill a number of times, Urban, when he was still a member of the College of Cardinals and not yet Urban, wrote a poem in praise of Galileo as Italy's greatest intellect. And Galileo, shortly before that cardinal became pope, had written him a letter of congratulations that his nephew had received the theological doctorate, and so on. I mean, there were friendly exchanges. Urban was regarded as a moderate on the subject of cosmology, as open-minded, and this is just an incredible stroke of luck. Galileo decides he must take advantage of it. He requests an audience with the pope. They end up meeting six times. Galileo works the conversation around to the subject of cosmology. Urban made clear his belief that humans were in principle incapable of achieving certainty regarding cosmological matters. Urban is very well informed on the astronomical issues. He's not ignorant. He knows exactly what Galileo's talking about. He argues that to develop a model that would make accurate astronomical predictions was not to prove the truth of that model. And on that point, of course, he was absolutely right. Many different models can produce the same predictions. Nonetheless, it became clear from their discussions that Galileo was free to explore the pros and cons of heliocentrism as long as he treated it as mere hypothesis. Okay, he could write a book dealing with the pros and cons, but he better not come down on the pro side of things. Well, it seemed fair enough to Galileo. He went back home, set to work, completed his dialogue on the two chief world systems in 1629. In the book, he presented extensive and powerful arguments on behalf of heliocentrism, unmistakably defending it as true. How did he think he could get away with this? after the Pope made it abundantly clear that that was not to be allowed. Well, at the close, there are 4 days of dialogue, and at the close of the 4 days, Galileo has Salviati, his mouthpiece, disclaim belief in the truth of heliocentrism, portraying it as a play. Salviati says to the other participants, well, guys, it's been fun to get together and make these arguments, but you know, it's just been pretense, just a play, just drama that we've been going through. So that was bad enough. But then on the final page, Galileo puts the Pope's admonition about the hypothetical character of heliocentrism owing to our inability to determine the divine plan into the mouth of Simplicio, the slow-witted Aristotelian laughingstock of the dialogue. Almost verbatim, almost word for word. The book was submitted for licensing. No book could be published without the license of the church, and it was, in fact, licensed. Galileo applied pressure. The poor guy who was head of that bureau, he was about to lose his head over this, I'm sure he felt. He knew that Galileo had been given permission to write a book, but he wasn't at all sure that the book he had in front of him was the one the Pope had in mind. But in the end, the book was licensed, published in 1632. It was a literary hit, bought off the bookshelves. This is written in Italian, by the way. Galileo's first book was in Latin, but then this one is Italian, meant for the educated public, and it was bought up from the booksellers as fast as it appeared on the shelves. The Pope discovered his words in Simplicio's mouth, probably with Jesuit help. Nobody believes the Pope sat down and read the book from cover to cover and, you know, got to the end of it. but that the Jesuits, it is assumed, showed him his words. He became convinced that Galileo had blatantly violated his instructions about the hypothetical character of heliocentrism, which indeed Galileo had, and moreover, that Galileo set out to ridicule him by placing his words in Simplicio's mouth. Such insubordination could not go unpunished. And it was inevitable that the machinery of the Inquisition would be put in motion against Galileo. The Pope just flew into a towering rage. And again, we have an eyewitness account from the Florentine ambassador. The Pope was, the 30 Years' War was going on between Protestants and Catholics, and the Pope was caught in the middle with Spain controlling more than half of the Italian peninsula and threatening the Vatican States and Protestants from the north, and he had to make decisions, various kinds of compromises for strategic reasons, and you know, everything was going wrong, and then this lands on his desk, and he goes into a towering rage and says, this guy has got to be brought to trial. Well, the subsequent trial was not about, this is important too, this is the second important thing, or well, maybe even the third. The subsequent trial was not about biblical interpretation or cosmological theories. That had been settled in 1616. 1616, the church had made its statement, heliocentrism is foolish, absurd, and heretical. Now what is at issue is the authority of the Catholic Church and the disobedience and flagrant insubordination on Galileo's part. So the trial is about something totally different. It's about Galileo's behavior. Did he or did he not disobey orders? And of that, it was clear to everybody that Galileo was guilty. There's just no question that he was. I mean, he was guilty of that. See if I have time for, yeah, maybe I do. I don't know, 15, 20 years ago, the Catholic Church decided to reopen the Galileo case, you may remember. A good friend of mine, a Dominican, was on the advisory committee, and he was scared to death that the church would, in fact, retry Galileo, because in his view, in a retrial, the only evidence admissible would be evidence available at the time, in which case Galileo would lose again. And imagine the public relations disaster. So in the end, that argument prevailed, and in the end, the the Catholic Church simply declared that errors had been made. So Galileo asked permission to make a statement. He saw that things were going badly, and he decided he better make the best of it. He asks if he can make a statement, and he is given permission. He states that he has reread his book and was stunned to find that he had, in fact, contrary to his intention, defended heliocentrism. And here it is. This is just part of it. It occurred to me to reread my dialogue, which I had not seen for 3 years, in order to ascertain whether, contrary to my most sincere intention, there had inadvertently fallen from my pen anything from which a reader might infer some sign of disobedience on my part. I was able to obtain a copy of my book, and because I had not seen it, he had to send for it. I obtained a copy of my book, and because I had not seen it for so long, it seemed to me like a new writing and by another author. I freely confess that it seemed to me composed in such a way that a reader ignorant of my real purpose might have reason to think that the arguments presented for the false side, which I really intended to refute, were expressed in such a way as to compel conviction rather than to be easily refuted. Well, it was a nice try, but it wasn't going to do the job. The Inquisition did, in fact, look for ways of being lenient. I mean, they were not out to get Galileo. They felt obligated. I mean, they were having a trial, and the outcome was clear. But they were looking for ways of softening the blow on Galileo. In any case, sentence was passed. Galileo was forced to recant. And here it's a long recantation. He didn't write it. They write the recantation. He gets on his knees. They take him to a church. He falls to his knees, and he reads it. And a critical part of it is the part that we have here. Before the decision of the Holy Congregation of the Index, that's the Inquisition, before that, I was indifferent and regarded both opinions as open to discussion, geocentric, heliocentric. But after the said decision, I ceased to have any doubt, and I held, as I still hold, the opinion of Ptolemy, that is to say, the fixity of the earth and the motion of the sun. There's a myth that Galileo, under his breath, said, yet it moves, but there's no documentary evidence for that. Everybody knew it was a formality. The issue is not what does Galileo believe, but what is Galileo going to say? I mean, everybody knew that Galileo was still a heliocentrist. For the remaining 10 years of his life, he was under house arrest, comfortably housed in his villa just outside Florence, with few restrictions on who could come and go. That villa was purchased by the Italian government about 20 years ago, and you can now it's been restored, and you can go just outside Florence. You can go and visit it. It's a very comfortable place. It's a nice villa, great view, high, and nice breezes. Galileo was going blind during this period, was almost totally blind by the end of that period, perhaps because of his telescopic observations of the sun. Few restrictions on who could come and go, and Galileo was even allowed out to visit his daughter in a nearby nunnery on, I think, more than one occasion. Galileo was not tortured, never spent one second in a dungeon or a jail or a prison of any kind. He was not tortured, he was not imprisoned, he was simply silenced. And I don't mean to belittle silencing. It's extremely important, but I know the difference between being silenced and being tortured. Well, that's the story. Let me just take a few minutes to offer you a take-home message. What would I like you to take home from this story? Galileo's struggle with the church has often been portrayed as a battle in the long warfare between science and Christianity. That, however, is a naive interpretation which ignores the historical evidence. Let me offer briefly an alternative interpretation based on the latest historical evidence, the most recent findings. 3 points. First of all, the Galileo affair was not merely an ideological conflict, by which I mean it was not simply a matter of scientific rationalism, more or less in the abstract, scientific rationalism against religious authority. It was partly that, but it was not merely scientific rationalism versus religious authority. It had also an enormous human and political dimension. When you think about it, science and religion cannot interact. Scientists and theologians can interact. And when human beings are involved, the interaction is never purely theoretical or ideological. There were political events that undermined Ehrman's authority and made him extremely irritable and suspicious. I said a few words about that earlier. Dominican Jesuit politics played some role in the drama, as did Galileo's alienation of the Jesuits and his apparent betrayal of the Pope. And of course, Galileo's personality looms enormously large in this story. Had Galileo paid more attention to diplomacy, I'm confident that he could have carried out a significant campaign on behalf of heliocentrism without condemnation. I mean, there is a sense in which he brought it on himself. It follows, in the second place, that the outcome of the Galileo affair was a contingent event, by which I mean that it didn't have to turn out as it did. Because it's a contingent event powerfully influenced by local circumstances. All historical events take place at a certain time and in a certain place, and that location and that timing makes a difference. The Galileo affair is not merely about universal or global aspects of science and religion, but about the local circumstances impinging on individual historical actors: fears, rivalries, greed, revenge, ambition, personality, political context, socioeconomic circumstance. All of those things enter into the Galileo story. And just to summarize that, historical events are situated in time and space. That's the point. They are contingent, local events, and our analysis needs to respond to that feature of the science-religion interaction. Finally, was this, in fact, in any sense, a battle between Christianity and science? It's been portrayed as a battle in the perpetual warfare of science and theology. Andrew Dixon White, in his book of 1896, which is still in print, it's gone through something like 60 or 75 printings now, and in 18 foreign languages. That's the story. This is one of the great battles in the long warfare between science and theology. But look at the facts. Every one of the combatants called himself a Christian and saw himself as a Christian. There isn't anybody you can mention in this story, in the most complete version, who is not a Christian, who does not declare the authority of Scripture. Everybody does. Every one of the major combatants also had well-considered cosmological views to which he, and in one case she, was entitled. The people involved were not scientific ignoramuses. They were people who understood the scientific issues. So looked at closely, the battle turns out not to have been between science and Christianity, but within Christianity, between progressives and conservatives, and within science, between progressives and conservatives. I have an overhead that may, in a primitive kind of way, traditional and progressive are the categories over here on the left, and now you just have to remember those. The real battle, it seems to me, is between the traditionalists and the progressives, who are willing to reinterpret revise their principles of biblical interpretation, and between scientists or cosmologists who are traditional and the ones who are progressive. And where do you see conflict? I mean, there's an alliance. There's an alliance right here between theology and science, and an alliance right there. If you want a conflict, you've got to go from one of these, diagonally related boxes. Where do you find, there's no point at which you can draw battle lines and put all the scientists on this side, or even most of the scientists on this side, and the Christians on that side. This is more like a scrum, like a free-for-all, changing ideologies, shifting loyalties, all in a political context. And that's the story. Thank you for being so patient. I appreciate it.
First of all, thank you for the talk. It was wonderful, and I agree actually with much of your thesis. I had also read that one of the problems that the church had was that they kept on changing and obfuscating certain documents, i.e. they even at one point tried to deny that they actually allowed him to print the book concerning the two world systems. And there was this whole little thing. I've never been able to find a good source about that or anything about that, what that really was. Maybe you can clear that up for me.
Well, no, I can't really totally clear it up for you. This process of getting the imprimatur of the Catholic Church. The imprimatur is a Latin word meaning let it be printed. Galileo got the imprimatur from a Florentine. It got the imprimatur in Florence, not Rome. At the trial, some significance was attached to that. Somehow that Galileo was being sneaky, that, you know, in Rome he would not have gotten the imprimatur. He got it in Florence, where it was easier to acquire. I quite frankly have not spent any time looking into the story further than that. It was a bone of contention.
That was a great talk, Dr. Lindbergh. I just wonder, how do you reconcile the rationality and the intelligence that you're talking about in the members of the Catholic Church with many of the other acts of the Inquisition, the belief, for instance, in the evil eye that you could curdle your neighbor's milk by looking at it, that you could be guilty of the phenomenon of mouse making, etc., etc. And I'm always reminded of the famous line. When I think of the generosity that was shown to Galileo, I'm reminded of the bishop, and I forget his name, who made the statement, kill them all and let God sort them out.
Yeah, I think that you need to understand that there was not a single Catholic Inquisition. Every nation and, in fact, regions had their own Inquisition, and those stories that you mentioned that come out of the Inquisition, I think that is probably not the Roman Inquisition that was underway in Galileo's day. The Venetian Inquisition, for example, was totally, if Galileo had just stayed at Padua, where he was first teaching, and would have been then under the Venetian Inquisition, and he would have been able to do anything he wanted without any trouble at all. So don't equate the Roman Inquisition with the Spanish Inquisition or the French Inquisition or any other Inquisition. You really have to look quite specifically. And of course, the Inquisitions change over time. Really, my own involvement with studies of the Inquisition have to do with the Roman Inquisition during this period of about 30 years.
Just to add a bit of historical perspective, when, in your judgment, when did the tide shift in the direction of heliocentrism? I mean, by the time of Newton, was it pretty well the obvious thing, or was Newton as revolutionary as Galileo still?
Okay, good question. I mentioned the Jesuits had this string of universities around Europe. Many of them, most of them, I think, with astronomers. In the years after Galileo's trial, those astronomers had to walk very carefully. And you find, it's clear that some of them are convinced heliocentrists, but they need to find ways of you know, staying out of trouble by concealing their heliocentric views. By about 1650, the wall is beginning to break down, and what really seals the fate of the heliocentric model for good is Newton's theory of gravitation. Once you've got Newton's theory of gravitation, then you've got really powerful arguments. So Newton publishes that in 1687. By the turn of the century, you can't find a European astronomer, as far as I know, who is not a heliocentrist. Copernicus's book remained on the index of prohibited books until 1835, and that's often brought up, in attacks on the Catholic Church. My understanding is that the Church had made its peace long since. I mean, all the way, certainly back to the early parts of the 18th century. But that there were delicate procedures that had to be gone through to remove his book from the index, and that didn't happen until 1835. By the way, just if I may add one point, the decree in 1616 was that the book should not be read until corrected, and a set of corrections were issued. Things you were supposed to paste over the bad parts of of the book. A former student of mine has gone around the world and tried to look at all existing copies of that book. There are about 250 copies have survived. Probably the original printing of about 500, but 250 survive, and very few of them have pasted that the correction.
Thank you for making your presentation in such a clear and easily understood way. The whole story was well presented. I had a sense that you have a lot more to say about the whole story. And one of the things that you quickly glossed over is that there was an actor who was a woman that was one of the cosmological players. Could you tell us more about who she was and what role she played?
Sure. I did mention. I said there was in one case a her or a she. This is the Grand Duchess Christina. The Medici family are the Dukes of Tuscany, and Florence is the capital of Tuscany. And they were Galileo's patrons. Christina was fairly quite well educated, apparently, and at a dinner that Galileo did not attend, she raised a question about biblical interpretation of those passages, those apparently heliocentric passages in the Bible, wanting to understand the rationale behind interpreting them the way they did. And one of Galileo's friends, one of his former students, was present at that dinner and wrote Galileo about it. And that led to Galileo's writing of his letters to the Grand Duchess, which was later turned into a published book, in which that's where he presents his arguments about biblical interpretation, arguing that, it goes back to St. Augustine in that book, one of the most venerable theologian of the Catholic Church at the time, short of Thomas Aquinas, perhaps. But pointing out that St. Augustine argues that if you want to learn about astronomy, you find yourself an astronomer. Don't go to the Bible, because the Bible is not a scientific textbook. Galileo makes that case, and I think this is one of the really unfortunate aspects of the whole affair. If the Inquisition made one really serious, error isn't quite the right word, but a wrongful act, it was ignoring their own theologian, St. Augustine, and the Augustinian tradition and its importance within Catholic tradition. But in fact, the Inquisition simply swept that aside. Thomism, the philosophy of Thomas Aquinas was prevailing, and the atmosphere, especially the atmosphere after the Council of Trent, was one of great caution about any kind of dissent.
You talk about the various
discoveries which Galileo made with his telescope, the sunspots and mountains and the moon, I would have thought that the most crucial was his discovery of the planets of Jupiter. How did the theologians explain away that here was a case of something going around something which was not the Earth?
Yeah, I didn't mention it just because I, you know, there are a lot of important things I didn't mention. They you know, they unreasonably limited my time to, you know. But the importance of Jupiter's moons is that what previously, an objection against the heliocentric model was thus undercut. The objection was that on the Copernicus's heliocentric model, there's only one planet that has a satellite. And so that introduces a new entity into the universe, satellites. There was no, you know, there's only this one. That seemed a bit ad hoc. Now Galileo is able to argue that, in fact, Jupiter also has satellites, and therefore, you know, there's and those are satellites on any cosmology. So that's the importance of it. I'm not sure I quite answered your. It seems to me I forgot some aspect of your question that you were.
What influence, if any, did Galileo's supporters and detractors outside of Italy have over the direction of his life?
Okay. Galileo, as you can well imagine, was, after he was condemned, he was an instant hero thinking of the good guys here. In Protestant Europe, Galileo was a hero, and so that, you know, simply the fact that the Inquisition had acted against him encouraged the spread of heliocentrism in Protestant Europe. His book on strength of materials and his science of motion was published in 1638, 6 years after his trial, smuggled out because he was forbidden to publish anything more. Was smuggled to the Netherlands and published there and became a hit and so forth. I'm not sure if your question went beyond that, but anyway, that's where the Protestants, I think, put in their major appearance.
A few years ago, the Catholic Church, they forgave or reinstated Galileo after 400 and some years.
Yes.
If the Inquisition was not about science and the Church's belief in the Bible and so on, what is the relevance or importance of that happening just a year or two ago? And what does it really mean?
What's the importance of the Catholic Church's pronouncement about a dozen years ago about the Galileo case? Was that?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Well, I guess the short answer is I don't know. The Catholic Church was trying, this has been an albatross around the Catholic Church's neck for a long time, an unwanted albatross, the accusation of that the Catholic Church was opposed to science. And this was an attempt to get rid of that. And as a matter of fact, the Catholic Church, the modern Catholic Church, has made its peace with modern science much better than conservative Protestantism has. Protestant fundamentalism, has tremendous problems with evolutionary theory. The Catholic Church doesn't have any problems with evolutionary theory, at least not as far as I know. So I think there has been a liberalization, and I think that was a sign of that, and maybe a step towards it.
I'm not familiar with the history of that time, but obviously you had to be very careful what you said, and suppose you were to be declared a heretic, I suppose you could be excommunicated. But what would it take, to be burnt at the stake?
Well, it would require a stake, and it would require... serious theological heresy could lead to one's being burned at the stake. The one case that I know pretty well is that of Giordano Bruno, the year 1600. Sometimes it has been argued that he did defend heliocentrism. And it's been argued that that is why he was burned at the stake, but that's not true at all. He was running around Europe, raising, making trouble, preaching heresy at every point, and that's what it takes to get burned at the stake.
My question is, what relation would be kind of transformation historically from Galileo, kind of where heliocentricity wasn't much superb explanation of the universe, to Kepler's law, where Kepler put elliptical orbits, which explained much better than the Ptolemaic system.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought up Kepler. Kepler is a contemporary, one of the few heliocentrists, and Kepler is responsible for elliptical orbits. Galileo and Kepler are in correspondence. Kepler sent Galileo a copy of his New Astronomy, which describes the elliptical orbits. Galileo wrote back a letter of thanks, but never, ever in one of his publications mentions Kepler or the elliptical orbits, for the simple reason, I think, that Galileo, I mean, this is a public campaign on Galileo's part, and he wants no complexities messing it up. Very much like a political campaign, you know, where any qualifications or any depth of argumentation is considered detrimental to one's candidacy. You just have slogans. Galileo wanted this to be a simple choice between a simple heliocentric model that has, I mean, Copernicus's model not only has, I mean, here's the sun, here's the Earth in orbit, but that orbit also has an epicycle, a little circle riding a big circle, and the Earth is, you know, riding a circle on a circle. He leaves out all of those complexities. He leaves out Kepler. He leaves out ellipses. He never mentions Tycho Brahe, who had a compromise system that most European astronomers accepted, because Galileo wants this a simple contest between Ptolemy and Copernicus, because he thinks that's the best way to win the argument. It's a political decision on his part. Strategic, but with political ends in mind.
So clearly the true story is more complicated than the one that is commonly told. But is it still not the case at the end of the day, after going through all these details, that this case of Galileo is still an instance of a conflict between the view that you can have revealed truth and the view that instead the truth should be investigated?
Yeah.
Surely that still stands.
Absolutely.
The fact that the church didn't just say to Galileo, look, the evidence for your theory is flimsy, so perhaps you should be more cautious. The church didn't just say that. It said, this is false and you shouldn't speak or write about it. It seems to me that the core of the common perception of this case is still true.
I agree, and I'm glad to hear you say that. There's no attempt on my part to deny conflict between science and religion. I think if you look at the big picture, it turns out that there are about, you know, if you want serious cases of conflict, major theories involved, you're talking about maybe a dozen cases in some 2,000 years of history. It turns out that most of the combatants preferred peace to warfare. And there's a continuous process, if you look closely at these events, of crafting compromises, finding ways of dealing with the problems so that peace can be made. I think the Galileo case is one of the very few where one of the participants had the power to craft the terms of armistice, to crush, which is really not armistice at all. But it's pretty hard to find another case, I think, like that. So the serious cases are few and far between. Tension is there, continues to be there, it will continue to be there. I guess that's the end of that sentence.
This edition of Celebrating Science has been made possible by Canada's Perimeter Institute for Theoretical Physics through the support of private and public funding partners, including the Government of Canada and the Government of Ontario. To learn more about the Institute and to enjoy other programs, visit us online at perimeterinstitute.ca.